The Berlin Security Beat is an original podcast produced by the Center for National Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. Welcome back to the Berlin Security Beat. I'm your host, David Bukowski. This season, our lens is focused on the world of cybersecurity. And over the next two episodes, we'll unpack the nature of cyber threats. Our goal here is to demystify the origins and motives of cyber threat actors and explore how we can fight back. We'll break this down into two parts: the landscape of state-sponsored cyber activities and the realm of cyber criminals. In today's episode, we delve into state-sponsored threats. We'll discuss threat intelligence and then look at China as a case study of what state threat actors can really do. I'm delighted that I could be joined today by Giro Minier, one of Berlin's top experts on threat intelligence. Giro is lead for threat intelligence research and analysis with the DCSO in Berlin and a former fellow with the Center for International Security and the European Cyber Conflict Research Initiative. Giro, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Hello, David. I'm glad I could make it.
Could you please begin by defining cyber threat intelligence for us? What is its purpose and goal?
So, like all good things in cybersecurity, I think all the best terms have no clear definitions. I'm pretty sure if you look at the UK NCSC's page on threat intelligence, they'll tell you as much. There are many competing definitions. I think at a very basic level, it does what it says on the tin. So threat intelligence about threats. And so you can define threat intelligence in a very narrow way, right? For a few organizations, it can mean sort of taking the jump from just being hit by and dealing with intrusions to actually picking apart malware, trying to understand what it is that you're being hit by and what you can do about it. And so that sort of threat intelligence writ very narrow. But then you can go further than that, right? So who's doing the attacking? What's the context in which they're operating? Why might they be prompted to conduct malicious activity? And I think, this is an endless rabbit hole. Threat intelligence can be as narrow or as broad as you choose to define it. For us, so I lead the threat intelligence research and analysis capability at the Deutsche Cybersicherheitsorganisation here in Berlin. We practice it in a fairly broad way, I think. Here I am with my policy background. The fact that I'm even sitting at this table shows that to some extent. But what we try to do is, as well as sort of practicing all the technical disciplines of sort of picking apart technical artifacts, of sort of creating defenses based on an understanding of the threat, on sort of being intelligent about attackers in that narrow sense, we also try to understand sort of who's responsible for the malicious activity in cyberspace, how they're structured, who their patrons are, who's directing them, how they're directed, what sorts of interests they serve, and then sort of turn that into actionable outcomes, right? So if you're picking about technical artifacts, then you can sort of come up with defensive measures on the basis of that knowledge. The same thing to some extent applies to that contextual and geopolitical knowledge too, right? So if you have some understanding of what's driving malicious actors in cyberspace, then you can make informed, or you can come up with informed analyses and assessments regarding, what they might have been after, what might have been driving them, what they might do next. And so that's, I'm not sure if that was brief enough, but that is what we try to do.
Thank you for that opening. I'd like to focus more on the geopolitical aspects of cyber threat intelligence. Could you explain to our listeners the roles that states have been playing as threat actors in cyberspace? And could you take the opportunity maybe to outline some of the key terms used in the field?
Nation-state activity, I guess, is my bread and butter. I try to be a China person by day. And, it's a bit tricky, right? And I'm sure as a sort of policy and geopolitics person, you know this. But if it was as easy as slapping one template onto sort of every nation state, what can states and what should states and what do states do in geopolitics, if it was that simple, we would have very little to talk about and we'd all be out of a job. Obviously, states behave quite differently geopolitically, and I think in the narrower domain that cyberspace, the same applies, right? So, what role do states play in cyberspace? Well, they tend to be fairly well-resourced, as you would expect. And whenever they sort of sponsor or direct malicious activity in cyberspace, that activity tends to hew to sort of nation-state interests in some shape or form. But, how well-resourced a state is sort of very dependent on the state itself. There are definitely a few sort of usually Russian-speaking, long-standing, well-connected cyber criminal enterprises out there that might and often do be able to bring more to the table than, you know, certain nation states trying to stand up sort of capabilities in cyberspace over the course of 1 or 2 years. And in terms of sort of what a state wants to get out of their activity in cyberspace, that can also differ wildly, right? So, you know, you could look at sort of conventional objectives that you'd expect to see from state actors in cyberspace, things like, you know, espionage, or, you know, military intelligence, the sort of things you would expect the sort of in the espionage space, right? But then you might have sort of entities like China who, you know, with the full and sort of slightly messy gamut of capabilities they bring to the table, have a much more pronounced focus on intellectual property theft and the sort of growth of and advantage to their economic position that you might not expect to see out of other states. You could look at North Korea, where sort of getting their hands on as much sort of currency as possible to fund other activity is a sort of big aspect of their presence in cyberspace and a reflection of their sort of unique sort of geopolitical position. So, you know, in much the same way as geopolitics, unfortunately, there is no sort of one-size-fits-all definition for what, you know, nation states mean in cyberspace. That's sort of why it's, you know, that's why we're chronically short of people all the time in this industry, I think. We need a lot of people who understand a lot of very difficult things. But yeah, I think in short, that's what it, you know, that's what it boils down to. There are a lot of states out there doing a lot of different things, and trying to understand those nuances and differences is important.
Yeah.
So you mentioned jargon. I guess you'd be referring to APTs. That's the classic one, Advanced Persistent Threats. And I think if you piece that that sort of phrase apart, if you pick it apart a little bit, you kind of you see the essence of the dilemma, right? So, you know, what does that stand for? Advanced Persistent Threats. It's generally used to refer to nation state actors. And you can see there's already a bit of a sort of analytical judgment in there, right? So there's a sort of assumption that the state actors must be advanced and persistent because of their nature, because of their sort of relationship with these nation states. But there's no guarantee that state or state nexus actors have to be advanced or persistent. Plenty of examples of that in the sort of China space. And conversely, there's no guarantee that every advanced and persistent threat necessarily has to be part of a state nexus. And so, you know, really, I think that's the maturation of this field over the last few decades, right? Coming to terms, I think, with the sheer diversity of activity that can be sort of, you know, present in this ecosystem. The absence, I think, of very sort of easy definitions that encapsulate everything. There's a lot of world to understand.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you. Could we talk more about China as a threat actor specifically, since that is your expertise? I'm wondering if you could go more in depth on China's role. What have been their primary motivations? What are the key trends that you see now, as far as you can divulge, of course? And feel free to provide some historical context as well.
Well, I mean, if you were to ask a Chinese diplomat, I think the boilerplate answer you'd get is that no such thing exists. The Chinese state has not been responsible for any malicious activity in cyberspace. So I'll at least give a shout out to that consistent government position. I think most practitioners in this industry would disagree, respectfully. So, you know, what role does it play? I think China in cyberspace has been a bit more of a hot topic recently, just judging by the headlines I'm seeing. Perhaps that's to be expected, but, you know, I'm sure you've seen this as well, right? Lots of high-profile incidents, lots of discussion on what China in cyberspace might look like in the event of a Taiwan contingency, that sort of thing. And I think, you know, you kind of do have to take a historical look because, you know, this isn't really a new phenomenon. Sort of China and China nexus malicious activity in cyberspace has been a topic really for decades at this point, right? So if you want to go back sort of really historically, then, you know, you're talking about patriotic hacking or sort of activity sets like Byzantine Hades causing headaches for the United States, you know, from the sort of 1990s into the early 2000s. We're talking about sort of a decades old ecosystem, pool of talent, you know, relationships, all of that sort of thing. And, it's a really important starting point, I think. I think that's where a lot of the thinking, a lot of the capabilities, a lot of the weird ways sometimes in which the Chinese sort of state cyberspace nexus is structured can be traced back to. In general, I think you could characterize China and cyberspace as being, you know, significant, prolific, and not very headline-grabbing. And I think that's sort of why, you know, we find ourselves in this situation now, where you have all sorts of high-profile headlines involving China Nexus activity in cyberspace in a sense of, you know, what do we do about this? Where has this all come from? For people who have been in this field, you know, in most cases much longer than I have, you know, this is old news, right? So it was, you know, early last decade that Keith Alexander, who was director of the NSA at the time, I think described, I think specifically Chinese or definitely intellectual property theft in cyberspace with an eye to China as, I think, quote, the greatest transfer of wealth in human history, unquote. You know, and that gives you a sense of just how pronounced the problem was, you know, a very long time ago in sort of cybersecurity terms, right? You know, intellectual property theft, the transfer of secrets, the use of espionage to secure edges for Chinese entities in sort of sensitive mergers and acquisitions processes. You know, before people were talking about geoeconomics in the sort of hallowed halls of think tanks, this was something that China was sort of pursuing and developing quite actively through cyberspace for many, many years. And so I think that, you know, that's the starting point for a lot of people, certainly for us. For my organization, this was, you know, a key starting point as well. You know, around about the middle of the last decade, this sense within Germany that, you know, here we are, a manufacturing powerhouse under active threat, you know, by China. The Chinese government has made no secret of its desire to develop sort of similar manufacturing prowess. And, you know, here we are facing an absolute barrage of espionage in cyberspace without the tools to handle it. So, you know, that's, you can kind of see how, you know, things progressed, right? From the starting point in the sort of 90s and 2000s, the sort of birth, if you will, of sort of China and cyberspace, not just uniformed officers, but sort of patriotic hackers, of contractors, of sort of criminals co-opted into state service, then the sort of rise of intellectual property theft and the sort of pursuit of economic secrets. And then sort of, you know, in 2015, you have the radical reorganization of the People's Liberation Army. So the creation of the Strategic Support Force under Xi Jinping and the sort of transition period, if you will, almost in sort of Chinese activity in cyberspace, right? So I think most people will attest to this. You know, you see during this period a lot less PLA, a lot more sort of Ministry of State Security, and there are all these question marks about sort of where China will go next in cyberspace. Where we are now, I think, is a particularly tricky period where, you know, you're seeing, I think, in many ways, the maturation of China in cyberspace. You're seeing almost the end of that transition period, right? The People's Liberation Army has existed in its sort of reformed shape for many, many years at this point. You know, I think you're going to be seeing sort of more PLA in cyberspace in general as, you know, all of these different bits and pieces become accustomed to their new roles and taskings and structures and capabilities. You're seeing the Ministry of State Security sort of no longer as, you know, a structure in the shadows, right? There have been enough Department of Justice indictments sort of highlighting this, you know, very odd in many ways organization and its relationship with sort of diverse contractors and, you know, ecosystems, you know, quartermasters, so on and so forth across China. And so, you know, you're seeing those capabilities maturing as well. You're seeing a lot of work being done on the back end, if you will, right? So you've seen, I'm sure, all this reporting on increasing zero-day exploitation by China Nexus actors. And I think the question we should be asking ourselves as well, you know, how are they able to do this, right? You know, what sort of control does the Chinese state exercise over vulnerability research in China? You know, how do they pool, you know, this knowledge? How do they parcel out exploits? You know, who gets what tooling? How are these capabilities developed and shared in the back end? And I think all of these areas have seen, you know, quite a lot of evolution, I think, over the course of the last decade in particular. So, you know, that's sort of where we find ourselves. You know, that's the story, I think, I would like to tell. Obviously, we're seeing all of that in a time where geopolitical tensions involving China, where sort of the understanding of geoeconomics as an area of contention have become much more pronounced as well. So it's a sort of, these two things are coming together in a particularly uncomfortable way, geopolitics and China and cyberspace.
Moving to the beginning of your statement, you mentioned there is consistent denial on the part of the Chinese government that there are any cyber offensive operations going on, which brings us to the well-known issue with attribution of cyber attacks. Could you explain what are the key issues with attribution? You mentioned there have been DOJ indictments with some evidence. So how does that work?
Yeah, it's an art, not a science, definitely. And I think very few entities in the world have the capabilities and, shall we say, sort of legal powers to secure sort of attribution with 100% certainty. In general, I think it depends to some extent also, however, on the way in which sort of certain entities in cyberspace behave, right, and how sensitive they are about attribution. I think this is one of those cases. I think I've sort of mentioned this before, but, you know, the Chinese cyberspace ecosystem, if you will, is an extremely broad one, right? You definitely have very well-resourced, likely, you know, very uniformed actors out there with sort of high-end taskings and sort of tooling and a mandate to remain sort of at least fairly stealthy. But you'll have sort of on the other end of the spectrum, contractors working for sort of provincial state security departments who in some cases don't really seem to mind too much when the sort of finger is pointed at them, when they're attributed. This, without sort of getting a bit too technical, but there's a sort of fairly prolific tool used in a lot of Chinese contractor circles, sort of called China Chopper, as it's colloquially known in sort of security circles. And, you know, if you don't want people to automatically associate your activity to China, maybe don't use the tool that's called China Chopper, right? And so for a lot of actors, I mean, that's sort of really basic thing, repeating sort of the use of the same tools or techniques, reusing the same infrastructure. I mean, that's how attribution works, right? Ultimately, it's a matter of connecting the dots between things you've already seen and things you're seeing sort of down the line and piecing together as complete a picture as you can based on sort of tools and capabilities and likely intentions of who it is, you know, that might be sitting on the other end, right, behind their keyboard. It is very much an art. It's, you know, more than a science. I think the analogy I always use here is Plato's cave. You can kind of see why. So we're always looking at the shadows on the walls. For anybody who had to suffer through undergraduate philosophy classes, your lecturers were right. This does come in handy. But, you know, that's kind of the way it works. And I think for some practitioners, so, for example, for those unfortunate people who have to track the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, they put a lot of work into not being attributed consistently, you can tell, right? They're not lazy. They put a lot of work into iterating across operations, whereas some sort of China Nexus entities don't seem to mind at all. In some cases, they seem to get more sensitive when something is attributed directly to them. I think you can kind of see, right, in the way some threat actors react to being called out publicly, sort of what their stance on attribution might look like as well. So it's, you know, it's an evolving picture. It is difficult without a doubt. I don't think, you know, for a lot of the China Nexus activity, though, the most sort of curious thing, right, is that for some of the actors out there, they don't seem to mind as much as you would expect them to, that they've been identified as China Nexus, you know, located in China, serving the interests of the Chinese state in some shape or form.
Right. That's very interesting. I wonder if you have other examples or anecdotes about behavior by China in cyberspace that would give our audience a better idea of what's happening.
So, I mean, anecdote. So, I guess that implies that it should be something I was involved in, right? Because, there's a lot of really cool stuff out there that I was just an audience to. And, you know, this is not a field I could be in if not for the extremely hard work that's been done by just an unbelievable amount of people. But, you know, I've gotten to be involved in one or two things, I guess. I think my favorite's maybe a bit of an odd way to put it. I think anybody who's been unfortunate enough to talk to me in the last few years has gotten an earful about this, is sort of what I've tentatively described as the sort of China state nexus sort of quasi-ransomware phenomenon. And there's a lot you can, it's very sort of carefully defined, as you can probably tell, right? So state nexus in that we are talking about, in general, entities that are likely not sort of a bunch of uniformed officers sitting in a Chinese government building. We're probably talking more contractors with sort of working relationships with the Chinese state, maybe, right? You know, attribution is tricky. And then quasi-ransomware because, you know, they've not put in the hard work of copying ransomware source code that's been leaked on GitHub, but are using sort of even more bootleg tools, typically. So sort of Windows native encryption tools, that sort of thing. And, you know, basically what it boils down to is a few years back, there was a very high-profile indictment of a very prominent sort of China Nexus cluster of actors called APT41. And anybody who follows cybersecurity headlines knows APT41. They're prolific. They're opportunistic. You know, They are all over the place targeting all sorts of things, and as a result, you know, they've picked up quite a lot of heat, right? There's quite a lot of attention on them. And some interesting things that came out sort of involved their pursuit of what seemed like personal profit alongside activity that they seem to be conducting ostensibly for espionage purposes, right? A bit of an odd mix. So they might be going after, say, pharma companies in pursuit of intellectual property, but then they might find ways to monetize that access in some shape or form. And the most problematic sort of version of that was this sort of quasi-ransomware activity, which actually has the potential to cause significant disruption, right? So if a whole bunch of machines or capabilities in the victim environment are encrypted, I mean, what are you going to do? You've seen the headlines about ransomware. You know the sort of impact that can have. So the question sort of became, well, you know, why are they doing this? What might be going on here? This came up in this DOJ indictment, I think, in 2020, if I'm not misremembering. And over the course of the next few years, so this is where the attribution sort of dilemma really comes into play, you see these sort of incidents arise with sort of bits and pieces of connections that that are tied back to this original sort of cluster of APT-41 attributed ransomware or quasi-ransomware incidents. So we're sort of taking a look at this, you know, keeping an eye on it, right? Thinking, well, it's APT-41, so if it could happen to anybody. It goes through a sort of a few iterations, so some activity that's tracked as Deep Blue Magic. So under a completely different name, pops up a short while ago, and then some researchers do the work and, you know, realize, hey, this has some odd connections back to APT-41 as well. So we're keeping an eye on this. And then finally, last year, and it sounds a bit odd, but I think this is sort of the way it is for threat intelligence, it finally happens to us, if you will. So, you know, one of our stakeholders is impacted by some curious activity. And so my fantastic colleagues, so I don't have to do the incident response. That's why I don't have bags under my eyes, sort of go in to do something about this, and do some digging and find some interesting technical artifacts. I've got brilliant sort of technically minded colleagues who can sort of dissect malware, who can sort of, you know, analyze, sort of infrastructure connections. We all put our heads together. We've got this sort of backlog, if you will, of like several years of research trying to stay on top of this phenomenon, and we quickly realize, hey, it's ticking a lot of odd boxes, right? Some strange custom tooling that popped up all the way back in 2020, you know, in use by APT-41. You know, some other interesting hallmarks of this quasi-ransomware activity, the same tools, the same characteristics. And we sort of put the pieces together and realize, hey, what we might be looking at here is another iteration of this. And so for us, I mean, you know, that's, I think from an operational standpoint, that's how threat intelligence is meant to work, right? At a very operational level, you look at something for multiple years, you build up this understanding, you have the analytical assessment that it might affect you down the line. And then when it actually happens, you're in a really good position to do something about it and support your colleagues who are doing incident response, for example, in doing something about this. In, you know, a more general geopolitical China watching sense, I mean, it's fascinating, right? APT-41, I mean, you know, it's in the DOJ indictment. I think most people would agree. I think based on what we know about the people involved in that cluster and their connections to the Chinese state, this is definitely a cluster of actors who, you know, in some shape or form conduct espionage that is intended to benefit, you know, the Chinese state and, you know, some entities within the Chinese state as an end user. You know, that's what intellectual property theft is sort of meant to enable. You know, that's what you would expect to see. You know, for-profit activity within the context of sort of nation-state espionage is not unheard of, but something as sort of disruptive and destructive as sort of encryption events, right, as sort of quasi-ransomware, if you will. And the fact that, you know, they were caught out basically doing this pretty explicitly a few years back and have continued doing so for multiple years, most likely, right? I mean, attribution is imperfect. It's an art. You know, perhaps there's some other wild explanation for this, but Occam's razor says, well, you know, we're seeing what we think we're seeing, right? And so the question is, well, you know, well, there are a bunch of questions, right? Are they doing this purely for personal profit? There's a very interesting series of cases in Taiwan conducted by APT-41 many years back where they deployed a ransomware variant known as Coldlock. You know, it's very, very unclear. I think based on what the incident responders involved in that case said, that looked quite a lot like actually explicitly disruptive activity. That's a fairly huge deal. You know, if they are making money on the side, I mean, you know, by deploying disruptive capabilities against entities around the world, well, you know, what does the Chinese government know or, you know, doesn't know? Or what doesn't the Chinese government know about this, right? Because it's hard to imagine in diplomatic circles something like this sort of going, unaddressed, right. You know. So, you know, we go back to this point of the Chinese government denying that they've ever been sort of involved or you know, complicit in malicious activity in cyberspace. Well, the thing is not, I'm willing to believe that not all Chinese activity in cyberspace is sort of mandated and directed at the highest level, right? That's just not really how, that's not how state apparatuses work. And especially when you're running something like contractors through sort of regional departments of an intelligence agency. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of, you have a lot of steps between, you know, your country's leadership and the people actually with their hands on the keyboard. But disruptive activity impacting entities in critical sectors sometimes, right? Like healthcare or finance. Financial infrastructure, if you will. I think there's some pretty real questions there, actually, about the degree to which the Chinese state actually has control over some of what it's, you know, if not state, then state-adjacent entities are doing in cyberspace. And so for us, very satisfying, obviously, to see, you know, all the work that we did over many years vindicated, if you will. But on the other hand, you know, very problematic in that it raises these enormous questions that I can't really say I have concrete answers to. So, you know, the work continues.
How can and how do we counter states that operate so aggressively in cyberspace? As you mentioned, these are to a degree well-resourced entities. Not always, but it is probable that they are. Is there any chance of effectively defending ourselves? And how do we fight back? Especially as we try to defend not just the public, but also a really vast private sector in our developed, advanced economies.
I mean, right, like, I think for a very long time, I think the attitude towards defense in cyberspace was pretty hopeless. You know, it's this, as the old adage goes, right? The defender needs to succeed 100% of the time. The attacker only needs to succeed once. And I think it really is indicative of just how much maturation this field has seen, and it's a bit presumptuous coming from a whelp like me. I think for some people, they've actually been there to see this maturation happen. I just sort of popped into the field near the end. But I think the fact that we're moving past that and acknowledging that, you know, well, intrusions happen, and we have to accept that as a fact of life. And really, the question is more what happens in the defense in depth, right? What can you do to sort of secure assets and, you know, secure your confidentiality, your integrity, your availability, right? You know, after intrusions happen, you know, what can we do to sort of make life harder for the attackers? What can we do to be as proactive as possible in sort of ensuring security? And what can we do to ensure that we're learning the right lessons? I mean, the fact that we're thinking in these terms and, you know, coming to much more multifaceted conclusions about what defense can do in cyberspace is pretty heartening, right? So we've gone past that sort of old adage. We're doing a lot better now, and I think in just conceptualizing it, you know, it's what you'd call the shift to resilience, I think, is what some people might term it, you know, in looking at this space. I think, you know, we've seen this also in Ukraine, in the sort of like heroic defense by Ukraine's defenders in cyberspace, but also the, you know, extremely important support given to them by so many talented cybersecurity professionals over the course of, you know, many, many years, very much predating last year. I think we've seen, to some extent, just how viable good defense in cyberspace can be, right? And I think for, you know, a fair few people, this must have come as a surprise. But ensuring that you have these sort of multi-layer defenses in place and that you're resilient enough to do the right things when you detect an intrusion instead of losing your head, and, you know, all the other sort of attendant advantages that come with a good defense. You know, I think we've learned a lot of lessons over the last few years from, you know, from Ukraine and Ukraine's defenders. And I think these are all lessons that are being, you know, furiously implemented as we speak. You know, a renewed sense of opportunity for the defense. It's a bit tricky, you know, and I think going back to, you know, the more policy side of things, I mean, there have been attempts to diffuse, I think, the most problematic tendencies in cyberspace through sort of negotiation, right? Through diplomacy, through interaction at that level. But, you know, I think most people in the China space, for example, the Xi Obama sort of no spy agreement stands as a landmark to, you know, what you can't really achieve in the space, I think. Maybe that's a bit of a problematic way to put it, but certainly, you know, well, the China is spying on the US. That didn't really work out. I think it would be the consensus there. I think the verdict as to exactly what it accomplished is maybe a little bit more complex than that. And that's a debate well worth having. I'm also very open to the prospect of more being achieved through diplomacy, right? So in an ideal world, we'd all be able to agree on what critical infrastructure, you know, exists out there and shouldn't be targeted, at least destructively, through cyberspace. We're not at that point yet. It's hard to, you know, I'm very open to breakthroughs, but I think historically it's fair to say, you know, cyber espionage, well, regular historical espionage and historical sabotage haven't really been regulated through sort of diplomatic accord. I mean, that's not the nature of these spaces, right? And so, you know, especially in cyberspace, where in many ways the sort of costs and consequences of conducting activity, you know, of conducting malicious activity are lower in many ways. You don't necessarily have to have people on the ground in the same way, for example, right? You know, I'm not holding out too much hope. So for bilateral accord in this space. And so, you know, then, you know, what are we looking at? We're looking at, you know, learning the right lessons from sort of defense efforts in the most sort of heated cyberspace environments. So again, Ukraine is, you know, a very prominent example for very good reasons. We're looking at sort of new forms of sort of diplomatic cooperation in this space, right? So, you know, capability building, you know, among partners, sort of multilateral initiatives. You know, you're seeing a lot of thinking sort of evolving in that space. In diplomatic terms, maybe no spy agreements between between competitors isn't the likeliest prospect. But then, you know, there are other ways in which diplomacy can play an active role, right? And so that might be capability building between partners. That might be sort of multilateral initiatives to sort of better protect one another. You know, out of the United States, we've seen sort of a lot of thinking in areas like persistent engagement or, you know, hunt forward operations that, you know, really represent a step change in the way in which defense is perceived, right? So it's not just enough to wait and react when something happens, but you can be proactive in this space. You can sort of go into sort of allied networks. You can sort of look for traces of malicious activity. You can sort of build up your knowledge about an adversary before, you know, you reach, you know, a crisis point. So, you know, be as well equipped as possible for contingencies before they arise. So I think, you know, actually the last few years have seen a lot of evolution in thinking about what good defense in cyberspace looks like. That's involved a lot of work on sort of government sides in a lot of countries. That's involved a lot of private sector input. So, you know, again, Ukraine, it's hard to imagine that defensive effort functioning as it has without the involvement of a lot of prominent private sector actors. And so, you know, that's sort of where I would see the situation, right? We're in a better place now. It may not seem it, but defense in cyberspace doesn't seem quite as hopeless. That having been said, there are a lot of attendant challenges, I think, that come with this step change. I think for anybody who's been in sort of the cybersecurity space for the last few years, the discussion regarding sort of private sector entities, you know, their relationship with the state, how that relationship is meant to function in times of geopolitical crisis. That's a very open sort of issue, and there are people better placed than me out there who can comment on this. I also think it's worth noting that, you know, as you adopt a more proactive approach to defense, you can't really assume that malicious actors in cyberspace are going to remain complacent, right? As you detect them, as you attribute them, as you sort of add friction to their operations, they learn lessons as well. And so, you know, I mentioned earlier that the trajectory of Chinese activity or Chinese state nexus activity in cyberspace over the last few years has been one of maturation. And that's not really maturation that would have occurred if they were just doing their own thing in cyberspace without any sort of response, right? They learn lessons because they're being forced to learn lessons. And so I think that's something we need to remain sort of very aware of as we engage persistently, as we hunt forward, or I'm not hunting forward, engaging persistently, I think, but certainly some people are. But as we adopt these sort of new principles of defense and seek to engage with malicious actors a bit more proactively in cyberspace, well, you know, what can we expect in return? You know, how are they going to mature? How are they going to evolve? What are these trajectories? I think it's a whole series of additional and sort of very important questions, definitely from a threat intelligence perspective, that we're going to have to be asking. It's not a one-way thing. It's not just us who gets to enjoy the fruits of our labor and our lessons learned. They're doing the same as well.
Thank you so much, Jiro, for appearing on our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Berlin Security Beat. Remember that if you're interested in a master's in international affairs with a concentration in international security, please look at our master's program at the Hertie School. And we hope you will tune into our next episode, which will be focused on all things cybercrime. Until then, this is David Bukowski coming to you from Berlin.